I have been involved in a project looking at these influences of being of a host being infected on subsequent infections. And then a lot of the work I'll talk today was done by a graduate student of mine, Janie Christen. So infection decisions, as was mentioned earlier, really deal with this question of when a potential host is encountered.
Division of Entomology, Walter Reed Army Institute of Research. And, he's the boss. He's the head man for that.
Bacteria produces toxins that aid it in the killing of the host. It also produces antibiotics that reduce competition within the host. And it modifies the host environment to facilitate nematode development and reproduction. And potentially it could be influencing these infection decision processes, like Ed mentioned earlier. You know, why do they prefer hosts at different life stages, at different stages in that infection process? Certainly the growth of the bacteria and the changing of the host due to the bacteria could be producing cues that are used in assessing hosts. And finally, there's the insect host. As I mentioned already, the different species and life stages could influence whether the fitness benefits of infecting that particular host. And it also impacted by the number of founders that are already in there. As mentioned, there's an allele effect, so there's certain benefits to having a certain optimal number of nematodes initiate an infection. And the hosts encountered in the soil are often patchy in distribution. So this suggests that it may be possible that IJs are in fact having multiple opportunities, may encounter hosts multiple times. So there may be more than one chance. If that's not the case, then we may end up with more of this infect anything you encounter type of strategy. Those hosts may already be infected and variation in the stage of infection. And so ultimately the risks of infecting needs to be weighed against the risks of passing on that infection and what's the probability that you're going to have another chance to infect. So already infected hosts with conspecifics, Ed mentioned already in his talk, focusing in on this very early stages in the process where there's definitely advantages to coming into that host and getting established. What I'd like to focus on is much more long-term as we go out into here. What are the benefits or risks of infecting at those different time points? So certainly an uninfected host, depending on the species obviously, you're certainly dealing with potentially a higher risk of mortality during establishment, a higher risk of not finding mates in Steiner nematid species that are sexual, but you have potentially a very high reproductive potential if you're successful and others go into that host as well. Early on in the infection, after it's already started, and that's where Ed was showing how that herding idea comes into play, you get all those benefits, but you lose a lot of the risk associated with the mortality during the infection process and failing to reproduce. And then once you get out into here, presumably that host would not be very favorable to infect. The nutrition conditions are less favorable. You'll be out of sync with a lot of the other life stages that are cycling through, and so your reproductive success would be predicted to be lower. So if an IJ encounters a host, how is it able to tell the stage of that infection? There's been a number of things that have been identified, although really for many of these, there's very few specific compounds that we know influence infective stage behavior. Carbon dioxide was one of the first ones that has had a lot of work done, and it's been shown that they actively respond to that cue. Things in host excretory products, bacterial symbionts as a whole, shown to function in terms of attraction or arrestant, pH, host exudates, influence the behavior, and also contact cues. But most of these are fairly general categories. The one that we do know a fair amount about is carbon dioxide, and I'll focus on that one in today's talk as something that we can track relatively easily and something that's been shown in advance to have some influence on behavior. And so what we did is we measured carbon dioxide production from infected hosts. We put them in small tubes and hooked them up to a respirometer. And we did various treatments looking at different insect species, Galeria melanella and Tenebrio molitor. We could look at them whether they were infected with nematodes, whether they were infected with just the bacteria itself, or whether they were uninfected, either alive or dead, or infected with YS broth, a control for injecting the bacteria. And this is just an example of the type of pattern that we see. Down here we have CO2 levels, and this is microliters produced per minute. And over here we have time after infection going out to 240 hours after infection. These are the infected hosts, and what we see characteristically in the cyanamatids is these two peaks of carbon dioxide production that come off of that infected host. This is a live host, it's relatively stable, and then this is a dead, uninfected host. Doesn't really produce much carbon dioxide at all. And then these show the stage distributions within the host. So this is early on in the infection when you have a lot of adults present. And you know, if we were just looking at peaks of CO2 and responding to higher CO2 concentrations, that would match up pretty well to an optimal time for a nematode to infect. However, we also get a peak way out here, which is much later, when we wouldn't predict it would necessarily be a good time to infect. And just to show you some summary of a previous graduate student's project, looking at a number of different nematode species in Galeria melanella, and we see the same general pattern, although the specific heights and times of those peaks do vary. In a different host, Nebrio molitor, we see primarily that first peak, and then it sort of declines. So there's definitely host effects involved with this as well that influence whether they're producing these spikes of CO2. So we looked at host attraction using the standard sort of auger plate with an insect in one treatment and one pipette tip and not in the other, and then releasing nematodes and looking at how they distribute. And we'd give them choice between an infected host at different time points or an uninfected host or two blanks treatments. And just to summarize that, when we look at long-range attraction, we see no real difference between the infected and the uninfected hosts, even though there's change in this pattern of carbon dioxide production. So it suggests to us, and this is a similar pattern for all the different species that we looked at, that CO2 may not be involved as a long-range cue in this case. So changes in the level isn't involved in the long-range cue response. However, it may be involved in more close range, perhaps involved in the nematodes finding the spiracles and entering and initiating an infection. So more of those downstream processes may come into play. So we use the sand tube assay that Ed described earlier. We use treatments of no larvae, uninfected, 24, 48, and 72 hours post-infection hosts. And then we added the IJs. And then rinsed the sand and counted the IJs that remained and then calculated the number that had entered. And what we see in no-choice tests is that the number entering does decline as we go through time, which is what we would predict. These hosts out to 72 hours are declining in their quality as a resource. And if we do, we compare them to the original zero-hour infection levels, all time points afterwards are significantly lower in terms of their infection. If we look at, that was with Galeria melanella. If we look with Tenebrio, we see the same general pattern, a lot more variation, and only the last two time points are significantly different from the zero-hour controls. But it does suggest that there are some cues involved that are changing that are influencing these nematodes' decision to infect. But we would also look at this in a choice bioassay as well, similar to what was laid out before. We set up different levels of time after post-infection, 48, 24, or uninfected, set them up in all the different combinations, and then compare them to sand without the IJs as controls for infection level. And basically what we do is we look at dissect the host, count the nematodes that are in it, adjust that number by the number that are present in hosts that weren't exposed a second time to IJs, and then using that number as an Abbott's correction, and then we fix the control variation using bootstrapping, and then compare them with paired t-tests. And so we have uninfected here, uninfected 24-hour, 48, and uninfected 24 and 24, two of the same time points, 24 and 48, and 48 and 48. And the only one that was significantly different was here at 24 hours, where we see a significant preference by Steiner-Niemann Rio Bravo for 24-hour infected hosts over uninfected hosts, which is consistent with what Ed was showing as things happening early on. However, once we get further out, there's essentially no difference between them, so they're not really able to discriminate between the other time points in terms of infection, although the trend was to have less infection as you went out. For Tenebrio molitor, again, we see the pattern. There's no graph is set up exactly the same, but here there are no significant differences among any of the different treatments. So in this host, unable to discriminate those two. So I mentioned the bacteria, and what we were interested in seeing was what role the bacteria might play in these sort of factors influencing the preference for hosts at certain time points after infection. So what role is the bacteria? And the nice thing about it is that we can culture bacteria outside the host. We can inject it into the insect alone without the nematodes, and then compare similar things that we measured with the complex of the nematode and the bacteria together to see what kind of role it might play. So we isolated primary phase bacteria, injected it, a number of cells estimated from the literature, a rough estimate of how many might be involved in establishing an initial infection. And then we look at bacterial counts at different time points after infection by surface sterilizing the hosts, homogenizing them, and doing serial dilutions of the homogenate and counting colony forming units. The problem we ran into is that we found a lot of other bacteria in these hosts once we started looking at them. And this is similar to the findings of Isaacson and Webster, that for Steinernema rio brave and its Xenorhabditis cabellonensis, that they've reported that there's a tendency for them to not have a strong suppression of other bacteria species. So this Xenorhabditis species produce antibiotics that suppress the growth of competing bacteria.